Introduce our main speaker for this evening, Billy B. from Lakeside, California.
I assume this is my water down here. I'm Billy Brace. I happen to be an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be among my loving friends, as well as those of you who aren't my loving friends. Well, I don't know how this is all going to come out tonight, because I want to congratulate the Greg and Jackie who got their five-year cakes for this month of November. This is my birthday month also this month. I got sober November the 4th, 1968. I've been sober 40 years as of this month. And I say that to impress me, not to impress you, because when I got here, I didn't look quite this good, let me tell you. I was born in Oklahoma. And you know, when you're born in Oklahoma, you start off with a bad case of dumbass to start with. And it hasn't improved much since then, the time. But I was born into a family that were drinkers, and I'm sure there were drugs in those days, but nobody ever said anything about drugs in those days. And my family couldn't take care of me very well. And so consequently, when I was 5 and a half, they put me in an Indian orphanage in Anadarko, Oklahoma. And this Indian orphanage was ran by the Catholic St. Patrick's Orphanage. And it was primarily Indians and blacks. And I was the only blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy in the group. And you know, when we played cowboys and Indians, you know who lost every goddamn time. They used to whip my ass every week, whether I needed it or not, you know. And so by the time I was about 8 and a half or 9, my mother decided she wanted to be a mother again. She came and got my little ass and drug me out to California. I was out here for a couple of years, and my dad brought me back to Oklahoma. He married a young gal. And they had 3 kids, and I grew up in that kind of an atmosphere. And my dad was grew up at a time when he held most of his emotions and feelings pretty close to his vest. He didn't ever say he loved me. He never ever hugged me. He never held me. He never gave me a birthday party. I never had a birthday party or a birthday cake till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's just the way it was, you know. And I didn't feel sorry for myself about that. I just figured that's the way you grow up, you know. And so consequently, by the time I had all of this pressure building up inside of me, which I call mental cruelty, when you don't take care of your kids and you don't tell them you love them and you don't give them a better place to live and a better parenting attitude and better clothes to wear and that kind of thing, that's called mental cruelty. If you're a drinker and a user, that's what you do. And you want to save that money for the booze and the drugs or whatever else that you want to be hip, slick, and cool about. And so consequently, I grew up in that sort of atmosphere of mental cruelty, emotional cruelty. And so by the time I was 14, I took my first drink, and I got drunk, and I fell down some steps and broke my ankle and went to an all-night movie, and I thought it was really cool. I was real happy. It was the first time I'd been happy in a long time because all the pressure left me when I drank. And I continued to do that for a long, long time. And by the time I was 16, I ran away from home. I joined the Navy. I lied to get in. And by the time I got in the Navy, I drank a lot, got court-martialed for fighting. I got court-martialed for being late. And I did a lot of shit that just wasn't, you know, according to the regulations. And so I had this inferiority complex, and I just felt like I never quite made the mark, and I never did. And I had lied to get in the Navy, so I didn't have a high school diploma, and I didn't get a lot of advancement because I was stupid. And so consequently, when I got out of the Navy, I went back to school and finished high school and went to college for a little while. I left college because I'd gotten married and that wasn't working out, and I ran out of money and one thing and another, and then I started running from one end of the country to the other. And I drank, and I drank, and I drank, and drank. And so consequently, when I was on my last throes of drinking, I'd been married twice, and I had a son, and I'd ran everybody off. And every job that I ever got into, most people, if they go to work for a big corporation, work their way up in the company. I worked my way down in the company. And I remember I was called into a corporation one time, and the guy said, you know, Mr. Brace, we're doing an evaluation. You've been here 6 months, and you've been absent 18 days out of that 6 months, sometimes Mondays and Tuesdays. And I said, so, you know, like, so what? And I didn't understand that. And I was in the throes of alcoholism then, but nobody ever told me I was an alcoholic. They used to say, well, you drink once, a little bit too much once in a while, or you do this once in a while, or you do this. And you know, by the time I've got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd worked my way out of job after job after job after job. And when I took my inventory and I put down everything that I had done in my inventory, part of my inventory was my job inventory. And my job inventory showed that I had 144 different jobs before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I'd ran from one place to the next. That was what the big book talks about, was a geographic periodic. And I kept running thinking I'd find a different solution or a different place to live or a place where I could fit in or a place where everything was going to be okay and I'd find the right old lady and I'd find the right place to live and I'd have a nice house with a picket fence and a couple of kids and a nice job and a pickup and all that sort of thing. And none of that stuff ever worked out because I was drinking. I was using up everything that was vital in my life that would have given me a quality of life. And I didn't know that. I just thought I had a few bad days put together. I was born to the wrong set of parents. I went to the wrong high school. You know, everything I touched turned to shit. And that's just the way it was. And it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I realized all these things that had happened to me was due to drinking and using. Everything that I'd ever touched turned to crap because of my drinking and using. I would start off real good and have a really great face on and act like I was really doing something wonderful, but I wasn't. You know, it's like a monkey that's scratching his ass, you know. He looks like he's real busy and doing something all the time. You know, but I was still a monkey scratching my ass. I looked like I was doing something, but I wasn't doing shit, you know. And I see people in AA doing that. They show up and they're glad and everybody, you know, and you never see them volunteer for anything. You never see them go to H&I. You never see them pick up a chair. You never see them putting money in the basket. You never see them do this and that. You know, and all they're doing is sitting around like that monkey. They're scratching their ass, you know. And I only say that because that's the way I was in the beginning. I wasn't ready to do anything. I wasn't volunteering for anything. That's not my forte, okay? And so consequently, how I got here was I was in Amarillo, Texas, and I crawled out of some bushes about 4:30 in the morning, and I ran out of people, places, and things. And I didn't have any money left, and I'd rented this one room walk up in Amarillo, and I got back up to that room, and I just hurt all over inside. I was physically, mentally, and spiritually broke in every area of my life. Nobody wanted anything more. My family wouldn't have anything more to do with me. Dad wouldn't take any more collect calls, you know, and nobody would let me sleep on their couch and all that shit. And I just felt like my life was at an end. I didn't think anything was going to be worthwhile, ever. And I was up on the third floor, so I went over and I raised the window. And I thought, shit, I can do a swan dive out of here, and it'll be all over with, you know. But then I thought, if I do that and it doesn't work, it's going to hurt like a son of a bitch. And so, being the chicken-hearted person that I am, I backed away from the window. I thought, better not do that. And I went over and turned on this old, early black-and-white TV that I'd bought at Goodwill for $5. Turned it on, and Billy Graham came on. And he was shaking that Bible, you know, and I thought, well, he's good for a laugh. I'll watch him for a while, you know, and it's early in the morning. And I don't know what he was saying or how he was saying it, but this is what I heard. It changed my life. He said, if you feel unwanted and you feel unloved and you're not sure where you're going in life, why don't you get on your knees and ask God to help you? And shit, I was just drunk enough to try it, you know. So I got on my knees and I said, please help. And I said a few words and I cried and that was it. And I got into bed and I went to sleep and I woke up and I thought, I got to get out of here. I got to get back out to California where I'd come from. And put my life together and maybe get my wife and my son back. So I quit my job that I had, which wasn't much of a job anyway. And I do like all good alcoholics do. Got out on old Route 66 and stuck that thumb out. And it was almost sundown. And I thought, God damn, if I don't get a ride, I'm not going to stand out on this highway all night, you know. And about that time, there was a little Opel Kadett come by at about 65 miles an hour. It always amazes me how one drunk can recognize another one going 65 miles an hour. So this car stopped, and this kid got out of the back seat, and he's about 14. He runs over to me. He said, where are you going, man? I said, I'm going to California. He said, we are too. Come on, can you help us with the gas? I said, sure, you know. So I got in the back seat with this kid, and there's two blondes sitting in front, and they're arguing with each other, and they're jawing and carrying on. And pretty soon I figured out they were on speed. And they were arguing, talking, telling each other bitches, and then I love you, and then they're a bitch again, and they're arguing some more. I thought, oh, God damn, what did I get into here? And I thought, by the time I get to Amarillo, I'm getting out of this goddamn car, you know? But I got to Amarillo about midnight, and I thought, I ain't getting out of the car at midnight, you know, in Amarillo while it's cold. So I thought, I'll see this to the end. So about 4:30 in the morning, I'm driving into Arizona, and the highway patrol pulls us over. And I thought, oh, shit, we're going to jail now. So I pulled over, and they got out. I got out. The guy came up, and he said, let me see your driver's license. I said, where are you going, blah, blah, blah. And I told him. He said, okay. Who's that in the car with? I said, well, I actually tell you the truth. They're giving me a ride to California. He said, okay, get out of the car, girl. They have any ID? Well, they didn't have any ID on them. One of them, girl, had a Social Security, and the other one had a slip that she handed the officer showing that she had just gotten out of the Detroit jail 2 weeks before that. And I went, oh, shit, we are going to jail now. And this kid that was a glue sniffer, and he didn't have anything on him but glue, you know. And he kept picking up that bag going, I'd never seen that shit before, let me tell you. But anyway, we got out to California, they let me out, and a friend of mine out there, he was a Los Angeles Times distributor, and he gave me a job as a paper boy. Now, being a Los Angeles Times paper boy ain't too slick, because when you're as hip and as slick as I am, and an executive, being a paper boy ain't too cool, you know. So I went to work for him throwing the paper, and about 2 weeks later, he came in the room. I was sleeping on his couch, and he came in the room, and he said, man, I have to let you go. And the old lady's saying, you got to move out. You're getting too drunk on us, you know. And I said, okay. And I was getting drunk with him. I thought it was okay. And so I said, why are you not letting me go? And he says, you're the worst goddamn paper boy I ever had in my life. He says, you keep throwing the paper the wrong goddamn houses. What the hell's wrong with you? And I just thought, oh, shit, you know. So I went down and I saw an ad in the paper said, room for rent, house on the beach in Malibu. I thought, oh, yes. So I went down, knocked on the door, and this guy came to the door, and he said, yeah. I said, I'm here to look at the room. He said, well, come this way. And I went in and introduced myself. And he took me back to this beautiful room in the back of this house. Had a big bay window. It looked out over the ocean. I had my own TV set, I had a telephone, I had my own shower, I had a nice bed, I had a view of the ocean. I thought, shit, I've reached utopia, baby, you know? And we went back in and sat in the living room, and I said, how much is this room? And he says, $150 a month. And I went, $150 a month? I'd never paid $150 a month for anything in my entire life, much less a room for rent, you know? But, you know, I'd gotten paid for my paperboy route, so I gave him the $150 I got paid with. And I moved in. And while I'm sitting on this couch, he says to me, he says, "Do you drink?" And I said, "Oh, I have one or two on the weekends." And he said, "Well, I don't allow any drunken parties here." And I said, "Oh, I don't give drunken parties." And he said, "Well, that's good, because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous."
Wow.
Remember that prayer I said back in Amarillo? Here was my answer, and I didn't know it. And I looked at him, and I said, "Oh, that's okay. That don't bother me, you know. If you ever need any help, baby, you just let me know." About 2 weeks went by, and he came in one night, and he said, you know, and he's secretary of the Malibu meeting, and he said, "I need some help. A couple people aren't showing up to put up the chairs and make the coffee and put out the donuts." I thought, "Oh, shit. What did I do?" So I went down to this meeting, a Saturday night speaker meeting. I walked in and helped set up the chairs. I helped you poor bastards out to start with. You know. And set up the chairs, and I met two of the first people who became my dearest friends over the years. And I began to notice the people walking in, the people who were parking in the parking lot. They weren't coming in trashy junk cars. They were driving up in Continentals and Cadillac DeVilles and nice cars. And they were walking in, and they were well dressed. They didn't have a red bulbous nose. They had all their teeth in their mouth. They all looked good and happy, and they were hugging each other and kissing each other, and the girls were kissing the guys, and the guys were kissing the girls, and a couple of guys were kissing each other in the corner. And I thought, what the hell is going on here, you know? And I sat down in the back and I listened. Now, I didn't particularly identify with anything that was said, but the seed got planted in my head. And from that day to this, I've never had to take a drink. I've never had to go back out and use anything. I've never had to go do anything. And I told him, I said, "I'd like to try that AA thing on a regular basis." And he says, "Fine." And he took me to my first AA meeting on a Monday night. Not the first one, the second one on a Monday night. And it was the Venice meeting. Everybody knows where Venice is, right? That's where the debris meets the sea. And I fit right in. And I didn't dress that well in those days. I didn't dress as well as I dressed tonight. So I sat there and I listened to what was said, and I still didn't want to believe I was an alcoholic, but I still went to meetings. Because the reason I kept going to meetings is that for some reason people would come up and hug me, and they would shake my hand, and they would tell me I'm welcome. And that's probably the greatest thing that you can do for a newcomer. For any of you who don't know how to do that, look for a newcomer when they stand up in the back. After the meeting, go up and say hello. It's very important, because it was to me at the time, and I still do that. And that's what kept me coming back, is because people were hugging me and shaking my hand and telling me they were glad I was there. Nobody had ever said that in those cocktail joints we call bars and sewer pipes. And I felt welcome. And I still feel welcome in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting every day that I'm sober. And so I started going to meetings on a regular basis. I went to meetings, 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 meetings. I went to meetings morning, noon, and night. And I was still so fuzzy up here that I couldn't, you know, I couldn't get a paper route anymore. And I couldn't seem to get a job. So I used to sit in the Alano Club at 26 and Broadway in Santa Monica, where I got sober. And people would come in and say, "I need the lawn mowed, or I need the garage cleaned out, or I need some trees trimmed, or I need my car washed and waxed." My hand would go up. And I'd make $2 or $3, whatever it was. And in those days, $2 or $3 would last me 2 or 3 days, because a pack of cigarettes in those days was 30 cents. A gallon of gas was 25 cents. You could get steak and eggs at Norm's on Lincoln for 99 cents. So $2 would last me a couple of days, and it'd keep me in cigarettes, you know. And I just would hang out at the Alana Pub because the old-timers would talk to me. Anybody would talk to me. I could go in there any time of the day or night, and there'd be a meeting going on. There'd be two or three guys in the corner, and the old-timers took care of me. And we'd go to a meeting at night, and then the old-timers would come up, and they'd say, "Come on, kid, we're going to go have pie and coffee." And I'd say, "I can't go." And they'd say, "Why not?" And I'd say, "Because I don't have any money." And they said, "That's okay. We're buying tonight." And they'd take me with them. And then while I'm there, they'd scoot a pile of mold under my nose. And I'm like, "Yeah." I still love pile of mold to this day. And then they'd put me in the car and take me home. They'd put $2 in my pocket, you know, and I'd cry. I was such a loser. I was about 1 inch from being on Skid Row the rest of my life and didn't know it. And I'd go to that Alana Club. And I'd have coffee and I'd talk. And I kept coming back, no matter what. I kept coming back. And I got my first real sponsor at that club. And it was an old guy that used to be a bartender down in Culver City, the bowling alley. And strangely enough, he had served me my last drink. And I walked into the Serenity Manor a night for a meeting, and here he's standing there, okay, the guy that served me my last drink. And he was one of these old Skid Row guys, you know. He had an old Jack Daniels voice, you know, and he talked out of the corner of his mouth, and he had a cigarette over on this side, and he talked on this side. And I walked up the back door, and he looked down, and he says, "How you doing, kid? I've been waiting on you." I said, "Really?" And I didn't think he was there. I didn't even... He turned out he had 16 years on the program, for Christ's sake, you know. And I walked in, and we sat down and started talking, and he was my sponsor from then on. One day I walked in, I was real scared in the afternoon, and I said, "You know, I guess I just can't put two and two together. I can't seem to get hired by anybody. I can't seem to do anything." And he's sitting there with that cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and he looked at me and says, "You want to go to work, kid?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "I want you to go down on Main Street on Santa Monica, and I want you to walk in every store on Main Street. And you go in there and you tell them that you need to go to work and that you need a job and you don't care what you have to do, but you want to make some money." And that's what I did. I walked down on Main Street. I walked up one side and crossed and came down the other side, and nobody would hire me. And I walked into a Big Five sporting goods store, and they hired me. Now, that's through the grace of God. I wasn't that bright up here yet, okay? And this guy must have been nuts that hired me, but I went to work. And I worked there for several months. It was one of the greatest jobs I ever had. And I've been working ever since, you know. And today I want to tell you that because of Alcoholics Anonymous and this program and this 12 steps, I would never have made it without you and God as I understand Him. Because in and of myself, I am nothing. But with the 12 steps and God and the meetings and you and the fellowship, I am everything. Everything. And it doesn't make any difference whether you got 1 day, 1 month, 1 year, or 40 years. We are all a part of the puzzle. We're all a part of the picture here. All of this makes this puzzle go together in different areas of our lives. You know why God made us all different? So we wouldn't get bored. Can you imagine walking into a meeting and I'm dressed like this, you're dressed like this, you got a smile, you got this, and it's all the same? No. That's the reason God made us different, so that we can enjoy each other's life and live it to the fullest and be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And from that point on, my life kept getting better and better and better. Yeah, I got a better car. I got better clothes. I had a better quality of life. And I went to meetings. every night I went to a meeting. Very few nights, and I didn't go to a meeting in my first 5 years of sobriety. And I was sober about 2.5 or 3 years, and I'd gotten rented this unfurnished duplex. And I had to go to my sponsor and said, "Will you go with me to help me pick out some furniture? You know, I'm scared to go by myself." He said, "Sure." So he came with me. We went down to Broadway in downtown L.A. and the bargain basement area, you know, and picked out a bedroom set, a living room set, brand new color TV. Brought in, they delivered it to my house, you know. And I'm sitting in the house with all this new furniture. I'm lit up like a Christmas tree. I'm smiling from ear to ear. I couldn't believe it. Here I got brand new furniture. I'm only sober 2.5 years. I got money in my pocket, and I got a job, and I got a nice car. And I'd go to a meeting, and I'd come home at night, and I'd walk in the door, and I could smell that new furniture. I'd go, and then I'd go over and hug it. And then I'd cry while I'm hugging it, too. Tough old son of a bitch like me crying. Can you believe that? And it was wonderful. And it was absolutely wonderful. And so my sponsor said to me, he said, "You need to do another fifth step." I said, "Why? I've already done that." He said, "Yes, but you didn't write it down with the other guy, the guy I rented the room from." I gave him a fifth step verbally. I thought that was enough, you know. Wasn't going to tell anybody my deepest, darkest secrets. So Johnny said, "No, you gotta write this down." Actually, it was a gal that I knew on the program. My ass hit the wall one night. I didn't know what to do, and I respected this old gal that had a lot of years. And I said, "What's wrong with me?" And I told her. She says, "Honey, there ain't nothing wrong with you. You just haven't written your fourth and fifth step out yet. And you haven't done anything to do about your life that makes it worthwhile." So I went home and I wrote it and I called my sponsor. I said, "I need to do this fifth step with you." He said, "Okay, where are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm home." He said, "Meet me at the laundromat on Wilshire." I thought, "You son of a bitch, don't you realize how important this is? I'm going to do my fifth step with you." So I said, "Okay." So I met him over at the laundromat about 2 o'clock. And I walk in, and he's there, and he says, "Have you got it with you?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, go get in the car. I'll be there in a minute." So I went out in the car, and I come out, and he sat down. He said, "Okay, let's hear it." And I had about 2 or 3 pages, you know, long pages. And I started reading through it, and I got to the point where the sex part, you know. And I thought, "Oh, Jesus Christ, I don't know if I ought to say this or not, but..." I started telling him about when I was 9 years old and I used to fondle my girl cousins because I was learning about myself. And I was afraid that that was my deep, dark secret sex-wise at that time. And halfway through it, he said, wait a minute. I thought, "Oh, shit, he's going to fire me. He's going to throw me out of the car. I mean, he's all done with me, or I've done this thing to these little girls." I said, What's the matter? He said, "Nothing. I got to go put my clothes in the dryer." I went. So what that means is your fifth step is not important to anybody else but you. What you've got to say on paper is only part of you. Has nothing to do with anybody else. It's part of cleaning your soul up, part of getting yourself ready for the next level of living and understanding life, okay? And don't feel guilty about anything you did in the past at all. Matter of fact, go in your house tonight and stand in front of the mirror and raise your right hand and say, "Not guilty!" What you did when you were drinking and using, you would not have done under normal circumstances. At any level, anytime, anywhere. That's just not the way we're built. We're nice little people inside. We're nice little boys and girls just trying to get along. So anyway, I got a better car, got a better place, I got furniture, got a better job, you know, and things kept getting better and better and better and better. And I got to the point where I had worked on an old boat, an old power boat, and I cleaned it all up, and then I sold it for $10,000. And I was running around having a great time, buying nice clothes, you know. My sponsor said, "Didn't you tell me you wanted to go to Europe one time?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, why don't you go, you dumb little bastard, before you spend all your money?" Oh, okay. So I got a plane. I flew over to London. I was over there 6 weeks. And I went to London and Paris and Amsterdam and Copenhagen and took the night train to Madrid. Isn't that a fantastic saying? Oh, I've been on the night train to Madrid. And I went to Madrid and I walked around the arena where the bullfights were and stood in the middle of this historical arena. And I went to the museum and I saw all the things that these great historical bullfighters had done. They were in this gallery. And I thought that was just fantastic, you know. And then I got on a train and I went down to Valencia, Spain. I had a spiritual awakening there. And I walked into this church, and there were the nuns were in there, and they were taking people around on a tour through this big cathedral. And when we went to the first alcove, there was a big thing there with a valise with rubies all the way around it, a big cup. And everybody was oohing and aahing, and they were talking in Spanish, and I didn't understand what they were saying. And we walked all the way around, we came back, and I asked the nun, I said, "What was that all about with that first thing?" And she said, "Well, that was the chalice that Jesus Christ drank out of at the Last Supper." And I fell apart. A mortal guy like me, seeing this cup that Jesus had drank out of. I couldn't believe it. Could not believe it. And I walked outside and cried. I was sitting on a bench and I looked up. And everywhere you go in Europe, there are pigeons everywhere. Everywhere. And I looked up on this roof and they were all standing on the roof. And all at once they got up and flew. And they went around the church. They lit again on the roof. They were all pure white. That was a spiritual awakening. I thought God was talking to me. I thought I'd been anointed, you know. And I felt so good. I finished the trip. And I came back to the United States. Well, I ended up in Rome, finally. And I knew a gal who was working at the consulate that I met in L.A. and A.A. She took me around Rome, showed me all. Went through the catacombs, you know, rode the train down to Naples. I did all that stuff. And then I flew back to L.A. and got back to L.A. I was telling everybody what the wonderful trip that I'd had and why and how it had happened because I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that I didn't drink. You know. And over the years, it continued to get better and better, and I got different jobs and I did different things. And I was able to go back into the Reserve Navy, and I retired from the Navy 10, 12 years ago now. And I did a lot of other things in my life, work-wise, you know, that I won't go into now. But every step of the way has been a little bit different for me. It's been a little better income for me. It's been a little better place for me in my life, okay? And for a guy that came here who had nothing going for him in every area of his life, you're looking at a miracle standing up here tonight, okay, because of this program. And I want to tell you that if you stay sober and do the right thing and do rigorously honest and work your steps, don't lie, cheat, or steal, and don't take advantage of the innocent, I'll guarantee you this, which is the same guarantee they gave me, that you cannot stop it from getting better in every area of your life, bar none. That's just the way it is. And so, I'll leave you with this. Over the years, I've done a lot of things in AA. I've been on H&I for 11 years, off and on, going to institutions and road camps. And I've been in and out of the women's prisons and the men's prisons on both sides. Thank God they let me out. And I've always done 12-step work whenever and wherever I can. I reach my hand out. I'm still a good member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous today because I didn't drink. And because of that, all this cloudiness went away, and I was able to marry a lady on this program 22 years ago. She died 4 years ago from pancreatic cancer. She had 23 years of sobriety when she passed away. And she and I worked together from the time we got married right up until about 10 years ago. And I had my own business at that time. She was working at the bank. She was taking care of the books. She was taking care of me. She was taking care of the house. I was taking care of her. I made sure that her car was always washed, always had gas. She never had to go get the oil changed. When she got in her car, she put the key in and it would start. And she could go to work and not have to worry about any of that thing. And we had a deal in our marriage. And the deal was, you take care of the inside of the house, honey, and I'll take care of the inside, outside, which is the car, the lawn, the landscaping, the pool, the painting, any of the stuff on the outside. You just take care of the inside. And, of course, that laps over once in a while. But it worked for us, you know. And during that time, we built up things, and we bought property up in Montana. And we continued to buy property up in Montana. And I continued to work and build my business up. And it gave me one hell of an income, let me tell you, because of the program. And 10 years ago, or a little over 10 years ago now, we both retired at the same time. And we had enough money to live for the rest of our lives because of the property that we had and the income we have off rentals and the money we had put away in different ways. And it's still that way today. I retired from my own company. She retired from the bank. And I'm very happy about that. I'm sorry she's not with me now. But I have a wonderful life today. Better than I ever thought possible. Ever. And if I don't screw anything up, I'll have enough money to live on until I'm 105. That's just the way it is, baby. And on my birthday, I had a great, great birthday party a week ago, Saturday, out at the, because I retired Navy, I had it out at Admiral Baker Field in the ballroom. And I paid for the whole goddamn thing. And I told everybody that came, this is a celebration in sobriety. This is you and I living together, having fun together, being sober together, having a program that's the best thing that any of us who are alcoholics could ever have. And that's just the way it is. If you stay sober, your playing field gets bigger and bigger and bigger. My playing field when I quit drinking was from that little room in Amarillo, Texas, to the bar across the street and back to the room at night. And that was it. And today I go to Hawaii. I just got back from Europe 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago. I have a son who's sober 2.5 years now. Lives on Maui. Secretary of a meeting, sponsors some guys in halfway houses. And I don't know if you could tell it by looking at me, but I'm awfully goddamn happy. And I'm very secure in my own skin and with my own life. And I hope you are too. Thank you for listening to me.